All right. Hello, everyone. And Don, just to let you know, that's the annual financial report that I'll be going over for 2018. It's a quarterly meeting, but it's an annual financial report. It'll show how we did for the year 2018, which was an interesting year because we bought a house. That changes how our financial report looks for the year. And the house that we bought, as you guys know, is the retreat house. And we've had two retreats there. And of course, I've been at both of them because I was leading both of them. And what's happened as a result of these two retreats is my commitment to meditation and my ability to stay in meditation longer, both have increased. Yesterday and today, yesterday for 1 hour, and then today for, I did a 2.5 hour retreat, but this was only 2 hours. I mean, 2.5 hour meditation, but this was only 2 hours of the meditation because the audio quit at 2 hours. So yesterday for 1 hour of my meditation, the last hour, I did 3 hours yesterday. I did it. Let me just back up a little bit. I did 2 hours, took a break, and did another hour yesterday. And for that second hour, I used this audio that I'm going to talk about in a moment as a guided meditation. Today, I did 2.5 hours straight, and this audio was used during the first 2 hours, and then the audio quit, and I continued for another half hour. The audio is by Bentinho Massaro, and it's an audio he gave to me as a gift. I don't remember the price for the audio. It seems like it's around $400 or something. He gave it to me as a gift about a year ago. And I tried the audio when he first gave it to me, and I would say it was too intense for me. Too, you know, he's masculine, I'm feminine. He's like pounding at the door in meditation. Jesus says, "Knock, and ye shall be shall open." But he's pounding. It was just too much for me, so I let it go. I tried the meditation again now, and it was still a little too masculine for me, but I'm able to abide with it anyway. And then as soon as the audio goes off, I notice my method shifts. It becomes more feminine. I'm telling you this story to set up the song I'm going to play. So this morning, after listening to this guided meditation for 2 hours, then following up with another half hour of silence, when I got up from the meditation, I asked for guidance as to what to play for myself, just to listen to myself right after the meditation. And this song is what came. So maybe after I set it up, you'll understand what the guidance is. If not, then I'll explain it afterwards. I got to share my screen. Sorry. When you meditate, you forget stuff. Stuff just falls right out of your head, like the share the screen thing. I hope this is the right version. Let me double check it. The image doesn't look right. And I know there's more than one song with this name, but they're not the same song. Well, let's see. If it's the wrong one, I'll stop it. Let's see if it's the right one. I think it's the wrong one. Hold on. I'm going to do another search. Oh, I can't while I'm sharing. Okay, I got to stop my share. I think that is the wrong song by the image. It doesn't look like the right song. Well, maybe it is the right song, even though the image is a little strange because it came up again. So let's try it. We'll find out. Yep, it's the right song.
If you want your dream to be Build it slow and surely, small beginning, greater end. Heartfelt work grows purely if you want to live life free. Take your time, go slowly. Do few things, but do them well. Simple joys are holy. Day by day, stone by stone, build your secret slowly. Day by day, you'll grow too. You'll know heaven's glory. If you want your dream to be, build it slow and surely. Small beginning, greater end. Heartfelt work grows purely. If you want to live life free, take your time, go slowly. Do few things, but do them well. Simple joys are holy. Day by day, stone by stone, build your secret slowly. Day by day, you'll grow too. You'll know heaven's glory.
Did you hear the guidance in the song? Anybody?
Was it do few things and do them well? Simple joys are holy?
Well, I think that's probably true because that makes time for meditation, but that wasn't the guidance that I received after the experience. Anybody else? Do you remember the story I told before I played it? The guidance was to go for the softer approach of meditation. Like I said, Virginia was pounding at the door. Let me in almost in the meditation. And then as soon as the meditation ended, I shifted to a softer approach naturally. And the guidance was to follow the softer approach, you know, day by day, stone by stone, build your dream slowly. Right. But I still enjoyed using Bentinho's meditation. because I do think it actually even affected my approach. Even though my approach did not become a banging type of approach, it remained a softer approach. There was something in it that shifted, a more intense focus, maybe, is the way to put it, a more intense focus as a result of listening to him pound at the door for 2 hours. So let's go to why we're really here, which is the Tao Te Ching. And today we are doing verse 11. And this is the Derek Lynn translation. 30 spokes join in one hub. In its emptiness, there is the function of a vehicle. Mix clay to create a container. In its emptiness, there is the function of a container. Cut open doors and windows to create a room. In its emptiness, there is the function of a room. Therefore, that which exists is used to create benefit. That which is empty is used to create functionality. And I'm getting a little bit of noise from someone that's not muted. I heard it during the song, but I'm hearing it now too. So there we go. Thank you. I have in front of me a delicious glass of water. And if this glass wasn't empty, I couldn't have a glass of water, right? I had to have the emptiness to put the water in. It's the emptiness that makes the glass functional. I'm going to show you guys what's out my window. I can. I had books all over my lap, so I stood and they fell all over the place. Let's see. Oops. Yeah, I guess I can just unplug. Let's see if we can see out my window. We may have to go outside. See what happens if we go outside. Hopefully I don't lose you. Hopefully my internet is strong enough to go outside. There we go. You guys are still with me, right? Oh, are you able to see or is it too bright behind me? Can you see anything? Can you see the mountain? Yeah, isn't it nice? You'll find that when I'm teaching from here, I sit and just stare out the window because I love that mountain. But do you know why I can see the mountain? Because there's space between me and the mountain. If that space was all filled up with trees or buildings or something, the mountain could still be there and I wouldn't be able to see it. Funny, I can't see it on your screen. Can you guys actually see it or are you just lying to me? You see it? I can't see it, but I'll trust you. Let's go back in and put everything together again because I stood up and unplugged my computer and I'm gonna leave the door open though. It's nice today. And all my books fell to the floor. Here, I'll show you what else I got going on around here. I was doing laundry, but I had to quit because it was too noisy, so I'll have to finish it afterwards. I guess if I'm going to give you a tour, I don't know if you can see out this window. I don't know. Probably not. Can you guys see the creek out there? I don't know if you can. No? Yeah. And I'm not going to walk that far around because I might lose internet if I try and do that. So. But there's a nice creek that runs along the side of the place this way, and then the Spanish peaks are out front. And I can enjoy all of this because of the space between me and it. Let's see if I can pick everything up that I dropped. The computer is officially plugged back in now, I hope. Yep. Let's pick up all these Tao books I got. They were all over me when I stood up, and now they're all over the floor. So, the point of today's lesson is that space is more valuable than most people give credit to. I remember when I was contemplating Buddhism in order to write the MPP Buddhism class, one of the meditations, one of the Buddhist meditations, was a contemplate the space meditation. So basically the way that meditation works, it's an open-eyed meditation. Usually when you look at the room, you notice the things in the room. You know, you notice the furniture, the, you know, things hanging on the walls, the things sitting on the tables. You know, you walk into someone's house and you compliment maybe their decor, right? That's what we notice. But in this particular meditation, what you do is instead of placing your attention on the things, like, I won't get up again, but my mom has some really pretty pillows over there. Let's see if I can show you her pretty pillow. Can you see her pretty pillows? You know, so instead of sitting here and thinking about those pretty pillows, I contemplate the space in the room. That's the meditation. And it's an interesting meditation because your eyes keep naturally falling to things. And as your eyes fall to things, you have to shift your attention back to contemplating the space. I mean, again, I couldn't see the mountain that I love to look at if it wasn't for the space between me and the mountain. Or I couldn't enjoy the creek if it wasn't for the space between me and the creek. I couldn't enjoy those pillows if it wasn't for the space between me and the pillows. So I might start with some kind of a contemplation like that, but then I shift to contemplating, appreciating, and loving the space. You know, I realize that it's the space that really makes everything else possible. You know, if it wasn't for the space in this room, there wouldn't be a living room, right? There wouldn't be this place for me to sit and relax as I share on the Tao Te Ching, or sometimes my mom and I sit here in the evening when she's here and we chat. There wouldn't be the ability to do that if it wasn't for the space. So what we do in that Buddhist meditation is we contemplate the space that makes everything else possible. We love the space. We appreciate the space. We have gratitude for the space. And to be honest, that's like a preparatory, you could say, for someone who's never practiced awareness, watching awareness. That type of a meditation can really help prepare them for awareness, watching awareness, because when you're practicing awareness, watching awareness, you're really doing the same thing. Awareness is more like the space. You know, when you close your eyes for awareness, watching awareness meditation, there's so much stuff. You know, there's thoughts. Sometimes there's emotions. There's sensations in the body. You know, there may be sounds that you can hear in the environment. There's so much stuff. And just like when you're doing the Buddha space meditation, just like your eyes keep wanting to go to things and you have to kind of pull your attention back to the space, it's the same sort of thing in awareness, watching awareness meditation. Your attention keeps going to the things, the objects. And you have to bring your attention back to the spaciousness, the awareness that's both aware of all of those objects and allows all of those objects. And of course, the form of awareness, watching awareness that I practice is specifically the loving consciousness method. And that's where, when you appreciate the awareness, appreciate that spaciousness, and you love it for what it is, and you have gratitude for it, to it for what it was, because if it wasn't for the awareness, nothing else would be possible. Nothing else would be possible. And another way to word that is, if it wasn't for you, nothing else would be possible, because you are the awareness. You know, if you take a moment to think about something in your life that you appreciate, you know, maybe it's your children or some memory, maybe some trip you took, maybe the mountain outside my window, You know, if you think about anything at all that you really love and appreciate about this world. Even the clouds here. The clouds here have been coming over the mountain for 2 days now, kind of round, like a, you know, they almost look like somebody literally took a tool and smoothed off the outsides. And I don't know why all the clouds are looking like this, but they're amazing. I've been watching these round clouds come over the mountain. And it's really fun watching these clouds. But if it wasn't for awareness, I couldn't do that. If it wasn't for awareness, or if it wasn't for what I really am, I couldn't appreciate or love anything. And so what we do in awareness, watching awareness, specifically loving consciousness meditation, is we contemplate awareness and we love awareness for what it is. We love awareness because of its quality. And it's hard to put qualities to it. So once I used the word quality, my mind went blank. I'm just going to say we love awareness for exactly what it is. Just like you can love the space in the room for what it is, if you really know how to contemplate that. So let's get back to these pile of books I have here. Let's go ahead and look at 11 in Stephen Mitchell. Let's see how he words this. We join spokes together in a wheel, but it is the center hole that makes the wagon move. Because, of course, you know, when you have a hole, that's what the stick goes in, you know, that then allows the wagon to go, right? I don't know what that stick is called. I'm sure it has a name. Axle, maybe? Is that the axle? If it wasn't for that stick that could go into the hole, if it wasn't for the hole for the stick to go into, the wheels would not turn, right? So we join spokes together in a wheel, but it is the center hole that makes the wagon move. We shape clay into a pot, but it is the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want. We hammer wood for a house, but it is the inner space that makes it livable. We work with being, but non-being is what we use. Wow, I love that. That's way different than, I'm anxious to see how Wayne Dyer finished it, because that's a lot different than the way Derek Lynn, it has a whole different message to me. Derek Lynn said, therefore, that which exists is used to create benefit. That which is empty is used to create functionality. And I can see that on a practical level. Like I said, if there wasn't emptiness in this room, we couldn't put the furniture in here and we couldn't turn it into a living room. If there wasn't emptiness in my glass, I couldn't fill it with water. If there wasn't emptiness between me and the mountain, I couldn't see the mountain. That's very functional. It's very functional. But I really, really, really like the way Stephen Mitchell put it. We work with being. Another word I'm going to use for that is the I am. We work with being. We work for the I am. But non-being is what we use. Now, use has a kind of a functional sound to it. Let's look at what Wayne says. Might have to look up the word functional here. Let's see, 11. Oops, I went somehow from 10 to 12. I'm sure there's an 11 in between 10 and 12. Here it is. 30 spokes converge upon a single hub. It is on the hole in the center, the use of the cart hinges. Shape clay into a vessel. It is the space within that makes it useful. Carve fine doors and windows, but the room is useful in its emptiness. Then he says, the usefulness of what depends on what is not. So functional and useful. On a practical level, I understand that. Maybe I want this to be not practical. I want it to be more, is esoteric the right word? And instead it's being a very practical verse. But I'm going to look up functional. I'm not going to stop yet. Functional, the first, no, what's funny is the very first synonym is the word practical. But functional is having a special activity, purpose, or task. Then again, it says designed to be practical and useful, working or operating. Having a special activity, purpose, or task relating to the way in which something works or operates. So what I'm hearing then, again, on an extremely practical level, we need the emptiness in order to have the things. If there isn't space, you can't put something in that space. But if I ask within if we can get beyond the practical, into a more spiritual practical rather than just worldly practical. What's coming very clear is that we have to be empty in order to be moved by the Tao. That's how we become functional. We have to be empty in order to be moved by the Tao, what many of y'all would call follow guidance. If we are not empty, if we are full of ideas, if we think we know how things should be, the Tao cannot move us. Just like, you know, the wheel would not connect to the wagon and would not move the wagon if it didn't have a hole in the middle of it. And that's all there is to that. We're required to be empty in order to be functional, in order to be useful to the Tao or God, however you want to word that. If we're not empty, we're not useful. Some of you may know that my spiritual path started when I got down on my knees on a Disney cruise and I said, please make me useful for the rest of my life. Well, in order for that to be accomplished, I had to be made empty. So the first 5 years of that spiritual path was what I call the purification. For 5 years, in a very intense way. And I want to highlight the word intense. For 5 years, in a very intense way, different characters came into my life to push my buttons so that I could see all of the fullness in me and let it go. And in fact, a sign that you are empty is when you live with inner peace. Because, you know, you don't have all of these ideas anymore that people are triggering. One of the places that I find that spiritual students, although I see a lot of sincerity in nearly every spiritual student I meet, one of the places where most, and by most I do mean most, 97-98% of spiritual students fail, is that using their upsets to become empty. I watch people day after day after day get upset at other people, get upset at situations, get upset at politics, and just continue to believe that they're right and that the other is wrong, and continue to try to manipulate and change the world and change others, change the president, change everything they can change, 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 because somehow, somewhere, they think that if they can get everything under control, get everybody and everything to be exactly the way they want it, then someday they'll be happy. And in doing that, what they're maintaining is every ounce of their fullness. There's one thing I've tried to say to spiritual students, kind of in a mild way, because I'm not like Bentinho beating at the door. I am a softer being. But one thing I've tried to say to spiritual students for as long as I remember talking to spiritual students is, if you want to wake up, don't ever blame anything or anyone outside of you for your upset. Every time you choose to blame someone else, and I don't care if it's your husband or the president of the United States, or you know, how physically close or physically far away, every single time you blame someone or something outside of you for your upset, you have in effect just said, I don't want to awaken. I prefer to believe my own crap. Thank you very much. One of the things I learned to do very early in my purification process was never ask the people around me to be different. That started off with Ron and Jasmine, the people at my workplace. Later, of course, Laurent came in, and it was him. He was the best one of all. I learned to never, you guys hear that word? Never ask someone to be different than they were being. Because every single time you ask someone to be different so that you can feel peace, you're passing on the opportunity to empty yourself. And I want to tell you, there were extreme circumstances. Sometimes I think when I say this, people think I mean except for the extreme circumstances, because then, of course, you have to take control. No, there were extreme circumstances. Again, if I gave you a tour of the condo or if I gave you a tour of the house, you'd find that it's, you know, it's fairly neat. I like to live in a fairly neat place. When Laurent moved in with me, he was exactly the opposite of fairly neat. I mean, exactly the opposite. Like, I'm not even capable of messing up a house as much as he could within an hour. I can't do it at all, you know, because I can't think once a house gets to a certain level. And he went way beyond that certain level. Like, he would open drawers, rifle through them. Stuff would be laying on the edge of the drawers, and he'd walk away and leave the drawer open. Some of the stuff fell on the, he'd just walk away. I mean, I couldn't even fathom it. He'd bring stuff into the living room and eat, which I do that too. But then he'd get up and walk away, you know, and he'd never pick up his dishes. There might be, maybe some of y'all live like this. I apologize. I'm not really criticizing that, but I'm trying to explain how I felt, because this is important. It's important to understand my perspective was this stuff was unthinkable. Unthinkable that you would eat half of a meal, decide you don't want the rest, leave the plate in the living room, walk away, and never return to pick it up. Just, it can stay there for the rest of your life as far as you're concerned, that half-eaten food. Just, you know, and forgive me, Laurent, I have to tell these stories. You know how sometimes when you take a shower in a public place, people will wear shower thongs so they don't get athlete's feet or something like that? Well, he wore shower thongs in the shower, which by itself is not a big deal, except he wore those same shower thongs outside. So what that means is the tub was always covered with like these muddy footprints after every shower. I mean, just the house was a mess all the time. And this is only one thing he had going for him that pushed my buttons. I mean, I can go on and tell you stories. And I'm sure you guys have heard some of these stories. Like, he did not have money of his own. And at that time, I had no salary and I was receiving no donations. I had no incoming money at all. I was living off of my life savings. And every time I wrote a check, that savings was going down, down, down. And I had no, do you hear me? Zero incoming money. And he moved in with me and not only began to spend my money, but began to spend my money on luxurious things. You know, like he had to have the most expensive of everything. He had this idea in his mind that everything had to be special. You know, I think everything being special made him feel special, which covered up his unworthiness, right? But he would buy the most expensive of everything, never even considered whether a cheaper one might be the same quality, right? It was just, he had to have the most expensive. And he was spending my money. And if he just got a whim that he wanted to go see his cousin in California, he'd buy a plane ticket. Didn't care about the price of the plane ticket, would jump on a plane and go see his cousin on my money. Oh, and that's not all. There was more, but I'll stop there. But if you guys really pay attention, what you're hearing me say is these things were extreme for me. They were extreme. They weren't little mild things. And my guidance was to let him be exactly as he was. Not ask him to pick up after himself. Not ask him to quit spending my money. In fact, the guidance went so far as to tell me to give him the checkbook and not look to see how he was spending the money. Extreme circumstances. And again, this is only a couple of the things. This, you know, I just don't want to go on telling all these stories for no useful reason. But there was something I wanted more than anything, more than anything. And the way I worded it then was, I wanted to know that the world wasn't real. And what I really meant by that was I wanted to know that truth was more real than the world. Right? I wanted to know that truth was reality, not the world. And I knew that I would never, ever learn that if I continued to do things my way. I knew that if I took control and kicked Laurent out or, you know, nagged him to clean up the house or took control of the money or any of the other things that certainly crossed my mind, that I might get some semblance of temporary peace again, right? I mean, if he had left, that would have felt really good. If I kicked his butt out and he had left, that would have felt really good at the time. I just want to tell you that. You have no idea how much I wanted to kick him out. But what I wanted more was truth. I wanted to know that truth was reality. And so what I did was I went to the Holy Spirit every morning, and asked for guidance. And every day followed that guidance. And in a year and a half, that's how long he was with me. In a year and a half, I went through more purification, which means more letting go of my own ideas about how things are supposed to be, my own ideas about what's true. I went through more purification than I think the average person does. I know more purification than the average person does in a lifetime. They never touch what I did in a year and a half. And the reason for that is, because the average spiritual student still attempts to change everything and everyone outside of them instead of letting go of the fullness in their own mind. I mean, I still now, I have a clean house now, and I like a clean house, you know? But I learned to live in an extremely unclean house and be fine. I learned that the idea that a house had to be clean was just an idea. I learned that there are just as many people that live in this world that don't have clean houses, and that if they're okay with it, the only thing that's keeping me from being okay with it is an idea. Do you see? And I let go of the idea to the point that my own house was not clean, and I lived in it happily. I learned that money maybe doesn't grow on trees, but it's not something you can understand. See, I thought I understood how money worked. You can't understand money. If you think you can understand money, you're dead wrong. Right now, I make half as much as I did when I worked in the corporate world, exactly half, 50% of what I was making. I have a daughter in college, and I'm paying her way through college. I'm paying for her apartment. I'm paying for her car. I'm paying for her medical insurance and my medical insurance. I'm paying for, you know, you name it, her phone. I'm carrying all of this, which is much more than I carried back then when I had a real job, a corporate job. And I give away. I was trying to remember what my taxes said. I think my taxes said I gave away 20% of my money to charity, but that's only counting what I give away to charities. That's not counting what I give away to people that aren't charities. I think I give away closer to 40% of what I take in. You guys hear that? I give away a lot. And I never run out of money. In fact, I look at my bank account and I'm like, where did that money come from? Like, how come there's money there? Let's see if I can get rid of it. I mean, this is now my style. I used to try to cling to money. Let's see if I can get rid of this money. I got rid of that money. Oh my God, there's more money there. Where did that come from? I mean, one thing I have learned is you can't understand money. And if you think you understand money, you're just wrong. And I learned a whole lot of other things too, but the moral of the story is, in order to be functional, in order to be useful to God, useful to the universe, you have to be empty. And even your most precious ideas, like, you know, how to manage money, how to maintain your house, how to raise your children, what your children are supposed to be like, your most precious ideas are just in the way. Another story, because we have time for another story. One of my precious ideas was that people are supposed to be honest. You know, if you're not honest, you're bad. And I suppose I can forgive little white lies. I mean, we all do little white lies, like telling somebody they look good when you really don't think they do. But, you know, on more significant matters, I thought you should always be honest. And if you aren't, you're bad. Well, if I was to climb up that little ladder a little higher, what I would find is certain people I even thought should really, really, really be honest, even more than the average person. For example, spiritual teachers. And especially those that we see as enlightened. You know, like if they're not honest, what's anything for? You know, like, is there even a truth? Right? I mean, if they aren't honest, I mean, this is really important to me. Well, there was a particular teacher who came to see me every now and then at my house in North Carolina. It would stay with me for a couple weeks at a time. Traveled a lot. Had a reputation for being enlightened. And he had a dog. And because he traveled so much, he couldn't really care for his dog. In fact, I don't know how often he even saw his dog, to be honest. The dog was more of a thought than an actuality for him at this point. But he did have a particular woman who was taking care of his dog. And while he was at my house one time, she wrote and said she couldn't take care of the dog anymore. And he got really upset at her. He wrote her this email. I don't remember the language he used now, but it was very strong, very negative, telling her how awful she was for not maintaining this commitment. And he wrote it in like very large red letters to make sure she knew, you know, how angry he was. And of course, he asked me to take the dog, and I didn't want the dog. But he didn't really seem to get that angry at me the way I remember it, but he was really angry at her, and he let me know how angry he was. And he was, you know, his face was as red as the letters in the email. Well, that was all, you know, I don't know, that didn't faze me so much. I was a little surprised at it. I didn't even think it was that big of a deal. And for him to be so angry was surprising, but I can't say I felt any angst inside. You know, it was just kind of surprising. But a couple of weeks later, I heard him teaching in Pal Talk. And every student there saw him as an enlightened teacher. There was even some talk about him being enlightened. And the way that conversation went about him being enlightened, it led up to him saying this: I never get angry. That's when all of my emotions just went, because I knew that was a big lie. You know, I had seen him very angry over a tiny little thing just a couple of weeks earlier. So this, I never get, here he is, a spiritual teacher, teaching spiritual students, claiming to be enlightened. They believe him, and he's lying. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You guys cannot imagine how upset I got. In fact, I went all the way to, is there even a truth? Is this just all a bunch of BS? Are all these people who say they're enlightened just making stuff up, and we're dummies believing them, you know? For the rest of that day, I was so upset I couldn't sit down with inner wisdom because I wasn't empty. I was full of all this chatter, right, about this. But the mornings are always better for me. Usually I wake up with at least some emptiness in the morning, and I did the next morning. So I sat down the next morning, and I wrote to Holy Spirit about this. And you know what Holy Spirit told me? I had to let go of my belief that other people are supposed to be honest. That's what Holy Spirit told me. That as long as I held on to that belief that other people are supposed to be honest, I would find situations that I would judge. That I had to let go of that criteria. Now, that didn't mean that I suddenly was free to become a big liar, because, you know, if you're on a spiritual path, you always want to be self-honest to the best of your ability. But this is, I had to allow everyone else to not be honest and be okay with it. I had to let go. And I'll tell you, that felt like ripping my gut out. I don't think I knew how much I valued the idea that other people are supposed to be honest. It was like ripping my gut out. I swear I could feel it. But I obeyed because I wanted truth more than anything. And I became a little emptier. I won't say that day because I think it actually took a few weeks for me to finish that job. You know, every time the upset came, I had to let go of it again, right? It didn't happen in a day, but it happened in a few weeks. And now people can be totally dishonest with me and I'm okay. Now, that doesn't mean, for example, I might necessarily continue to do business with them, right? You know, I can walk away from doing business with someone if I discover that they're dishonest, but there's no love lost. You know, they're allowed to run a dishonest business if they want to, and I'm allowed to not do business with them, but there doesn't have to be any judgment, you know? So again, I repeat, the biggest mistake that I see spiritual students making is not using their upsets as an opportunity to find what's in them that needs to be let go. And I don't care what the upset is. I don't care what the upset is. Everybody has an excuse, but this thing, you know, no, I don't care what it is. If you're upset about it, it's because you're not empty. There's something in here that you're believing, that you're hanging on to, that you think has to be a certain way. And if you want to be empty, you don't have to let go of it, right? I mean, you can hold on to that till the day you die. But if you want to be useful to God, useful to the Tao, useful to the universe, moved by peace, and if you even want to know peace, you have to let go of it. It's your emptiness that makes you useful. Right? It's your emptiness that makes you useful. When you're empty, the Tao is like a hand and you're like a glove. And the Tao can just put its hand right inside you and move you in any way it wants to. But if that glove is full of sand, your ideas and your beliefs, the Tao can't get its hand in there. So let me drink water out of my empty cup. Actually, it's not a cup, an empty cup. It's just a cup with emptiness that allows me to put water in it, right? And then we have 4 minutes left, so let's read these again. Let's read 11 again. So Derek Lynn says, 30 spokes join in one hub. In its emptiness, there is the function of a vehicle. Mix clay to create a container. In its emptiness, there is the function of a container. Cut open doors and windows to create a room. In its emptiness, there is the function of a room. Therefore, that which exists is used to create benefit. That which is empty is used to create functionality. Let's look at Wayne Dyer. 30 spokes converge upon a single hub. It is on the hole in the center that the use of the cart hinges. Shape clay into a vessel. It is the space within that makes it useful. Carve fine doors and windows, but the room is useful in its emptiness. The usefulness of what is depends on what is not. And then Stephen Mitchell. We join spokes together in a wheel. but it is the center hole that makes the wagon move. We shape clay into a pot, but it is the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want. We hammer wood for a house, but it is the inner space that makes it livable. We work with being. And, well, let me read this and I'll tell you why I love this one the most. We work with being, but non-being is what we use. We work with being, existence, right? This body, for example, your body, your personality, you know, it's all being, it's all existence. But that which comes from before being, which some of you all might call Holy Spirit, I've been calling it the Tao, some people might call it God, some people might call it truth. It's that coming into this world through our being that makes the world functional. Otherwise, the world is just a mess. And the only way the world can be functional is for us to become empty, the empty glove, so that the Tao can put its hand in and move us. All right, that's it. I'm done. I'll type a title in just a second. Thank you, everyone.